This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now an online store with the new Squarespace Commerce feature. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK3.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 88, Adjusting Their Babelfish. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including an extended cut of The Wounded, an additional showtime for The Best of Both Worlds, a chance to see yourself on the big screen as a Borg, Ensign Leffler's run for U.S. Senate, Bye Bye Robot's new Khan poster, and we speculate on recent Into Darkness news. Then in the feature, we're joined by Michael Fisher to discuss the DS9 episode, Little Green Men. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Ready Room. We didn't do a show last week because Greg was at the Emerald City Comic Con, and he met up with our friend Larry Nemechek while he was there. And as happened once before on The Ready Room, Larry locked Greg in a closet for some reason. So doing the show with me today, I have someone you all know from Literary Treks and The Orb, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how are you today?
You know, Chris, I'm doing fantastic. Great day today. For me, I went to church and then went and had barbecue. And then I was able to go out with my sister for her birthday with some family. So that was fun. And then I bought Star Trek Catan tonight. So honestly, I can't picture today could have gone better.
I think you need to pack a few more things into your day there, Matthew.
Well, I did also watch the episode for today as well. So yeah, it's been a pretty busy day. Oh, and I got a new roommate. So, all is well.
Wow. Now you didn't get one of these cat women like Kirk got in the latest trailer, did you?
I didn't. I was sad that no cat women applied. Nobody saw that Craigslist ad and thought, when you put cat women, like you're looking for a cat woman, usually you just get a crazy cat woman showing up at your door with like 60 different cats.
like the woman on The Simpsons.
Exactly. That's not exactly the kind of cat woman I was looking for. So I figured it was just better to look for a really nice guy who wanted to live with a couple of other guys and would be, you know, fun to live with. So
I see. And dress up in dresses and wigs and reenact Bosom Buddies episodes.
You know, we've thought about that. We also thought about, you know, it was disappointing. Couldn't find any females who wanted to live with us so that we could do the whole, or actually two females to live with me, so I could, you know, pretend that I'm Three's Company. There's just so many great sitcom choices for life experience to choose from.
There really are. All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump into news. Now, the first item that we have up in news is about an episode that I have to say probably would not be my first choice of source material for life experiences. And that's the Next Generation's episode, The Wounded. Now, we got the extended Measure of a Man, which we just talked about here, I guess, on our last show. And that was amazing, all the extra footage that was found there. Now, someone named Cyril Paciullo has acquired The Wounded from the 2010 PropWorks Star Trek auction, and there are about 3 minutes of additional footage, and he's put this together and released it on his website.
Yeah, I thought this was really cool to see that they are finding these treasure troves of, you know, TNG material, the extended scenes for longer episodes. I think it shows that, you know, with writing Star Trek, you can tend to have a lot of extraneous material they end up having to cut, and yet it probably would have helped the episode. Like, I think, you know, as you talked about last week, A Measure of a Man, it was fantastic when you added that back in, and I'm really hoping that these people will come forward more quickly so that this kind of stuff can be put on the Blu-ray sets, because this didn't make it in time to be able to put on the newest Blu-ray set. So, and you know, they even mentioned that hopefully some of the season 4 material might get to be used. So looks like we have a good opportunity to have a lot more of this stuff in the future.
It would be interesting to see. Now, of course, this stuff is on VHS. He got 9 tapes total in the auction, and there are 8 rough cuts of different episodes on there. I don't think they could actually do the kind of remastering like they did with The Measure of Man based on this, but they could put it as some bonus material. Like, you know, here is the extended cut. The tape containing The Wounded that he got was labeled Peter's Cut 11/26/90. Now, Peter Lauritsen was a co-producer on The Next Generation. So this is, you know, his cut of the episode, I guess, as he envisioned it, which was 3 minutes too long. So it had to be cut down. You know, they show a lot of the scenes, like where you have people appearing on the video displays, say in the ready room. The footage on there is the raw footage before it's put onto the display screen. So, but it would be interesting to see what that added to the episode, what was missing. And there, well, while we're talking about The Wounded specifically, TrekCore has gone and they didn't put the entire episode on TrekCore because they were not quite sure about the copyright and, you know, they want to play it safe. They have a good relationship with CBS. And what they did do is they did a cut-down package, and they highlighted 4 prominent deleted scenes from The Wounded. So if you want to see that, you can go over to TrekCore and see it. And we'll also put a link to Cyril's website where he actually does have the full, it's close to 44 minutes up there. It's approximately 3 minutes longer than normal. There are some other episodes, Matthew, that were on these 9 tapes that he got as well, spanning 3 different seasons. What else can we look forward to, possibly?
It looks like The Child, Where Silence Has Lease, Evolution, The Bonding, The Hunted, Sins of the Father, Brothers, and Devil's Due were all available on these tapes that he got. And so we definitely are hoping to see Brothers and then Devil's Due from season 4. And maybe even having kind of a special feature, I would hope, on that season 4 with the extras from season 2 and 3. Just as saying, look, this is something that's a treasure trove we found. You know, to me, just clean it up enough so that we can watch it in high definition enough. Just give it to us. I don't really think that I expect them to go back and do A Measure of a Man with this.
Right. Well, do you have the Blu-ray set? Do you have the season 2 Blu-ray set?
I do not. Actually, the first Blu-ray set that I'll be getting is Enterprise at the end of the month.
Okay. Because what they did on the Blu-ray set is for The Measure of a Man, there are 3 different versions. There's the original version, there's the remastered extended, and there is what they call a hybrid. And in the hybrid, they actually spliced in the raw video footage in the places where scenes had been cut from the episode. And a lot of it is extremely raw. You know, there are like no effects even put in some spots. But that works great. I mean, it's very interesting as a fan to see that. So like you said, maybe they can go back and just put that kind of material on. Even if it's season 4, they can say, look, here's Brothers and Devil's Due. And also, here are some from the past 2 seasons that we want to share a little bit of unseen footage of with you.
Well, and I think that is something that, you know, as a fan of extras, I totally respond to, especially when, you know, you get an animated film and they'll show you the extended scenes or the alternate scenes. And usually those are just the hand-drawn animation. And it's not anything that they've been able to finish or anything like that. But it's still always very interesting to see the other ways they might have gone with a scene. And I think this just gives us that ability to see maybe what a writer was thinking to kind of extend a scene or those kind of things. I think that stuff is just great.
Yeah. So this is really cool. I'm glad that this came to light, and it makes me wonder what else might be floating around out there from seasons 5 and 6 and 7, and maybe even other stuff from the first 4 seasons as well. Just bit by bit through this process, we're finding a lot of lost material about The Next Generation, a show that's been around for 25 years, and that's quite amazing.
It does also make me wonder just what else did CBS and Paramount, you know, get rid of when they did this huge sale that they maybe shouldn't have. And so hopefully people that bought that material will look through it and make sure that they don't have anything, say, for seasons 4, 5, and 6, 7 of The Next Generation. Of course, Deep Space Nine, Voyager as well. All of these things could be great additions to Blu-ray sets in the future.
You know, somewhere out there at one of those auctions, someone bought the reel of Andorian fight scenes from The Next Generation.
Oh, man, that would have been so good to have just back-to-back Andorian fight scenes. You know, Andorians fighting Riker, Picard trying to reason in with an Andorian that just really wants to kick his butt, Troy feeling empathic about an Andorian just saying, I think he's angry, Captain.
Right. And then there's that scene, you know, after the fights where the Andorian is sitting on the sofa in Troy's quarters. And then, of course, after the fights when all the Andorians go to 10 Forward to have drinks, and a Guinan starts counseling them about how their anger should be channeled because, you know, Troy, she didn't quite really know what to say to them.
Well, and then, of course, you know, everybody likes to make fun of Beverly all. Do a little bit here. that part where, you know, the Andorian comes in, he's barely alive, and Beverly can't save him.
Then the other Andorians come in and fight Beverly. Yes.
And what they don't realize is you really just don't want to tick off Beverly. She makes Worf look like a pansy when it comes to fighting hand-to-hand combat. So those Andorians would have no chance.
All right. Well, hopefully that will also come to light and make it on one of the later season Blu-ray sets. So we'll put links to all this in the show notes, and you can go check it out. Now, Matthew, while we're talking about The Next Generation, the Best of Both Worlds theatrical event is coming up on April 25th. And Star Trek, the official Star Trek, has come up with a little promotion. It's a Facebook app that gives you a chance to possibly appear on the big screen the night of the big event.
I thought that this was really cool, Chris. One, because I am going to be going to this event. And so I thought maybe I should do this. And then I could, you know, my face will come up on screen. It'll be going all around the country and people are going to see my face. And then they're going to want to put me in commercials and then TV shows and then movies. And then I'll run for president. And I think I'm going a little far with this. Probably just what's going to happen is I'm going to upload my photo. There's 9 different Borg-centric scenes that you can put your face in. You can use a photo you have from Facebook. It'll get included on the gallery. That's probably all that'll happen with my photo. But if you're lucky, you're going to get chosen, and you'll be part of that Best of Both Worlds event in theaters on April 25th.
Right, yeah. I don't know how many photos they're going to use, but they say they're going to put together a photo reel that will run before the Best of Both Worlds in the theater. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess it'll probably be a couple of minutes long, and it probably depends on how many fans take advantage of this app and put their faces on there. You might be there. You might see yourself on the screen. And, you know, if you're going to the movie with your date, I mean, as a geek, what possible way could you impress her or him more than showing up on the screen as a Borg drone?
Well, and if you're smart, maybe you want to propose, you know, to say your fiance or, I mean, your girlfriend or your boyfriend or something. And so you put on there, you know, will you marry me? And hopefully they'll pick that picture and you'll be able to propose and get down on one knee and have your Starfleet uniform on as well and open up that ring box and give her
is
that.
This where you
that you give her that, you know, that Starfleet insignia diamond ring and she says yes and you head off to Ryza for your honeymoon.
Oh, I thought this was where you go to the front of the theater and you kneel down in front of the whole audience and you tell her, will you assimilate me?
See, that's even better right there. And then you hand her this Borg-encrusted diamond ring, you know, that looks like, you know, she puts on the whole glove like Seven had. So, yeah, this is, man, we are helping so many geeks out right now.
We really are, yeah. I don't know if this particular Borg-centric scene is available in the app or not, but if you want to take your chance and see if you can get on the big screen, go over to facebook.com/StarTrek. It's the official site. We'll put a link here in the Enhanced podcast and on the show page directly to the app, and the instructions are there on the page for what you need to do. Now, still on the Next Generation, Matthew, and speaking of wanting to be assimilated, this is not exactly a Star Trek story, but I mean, everyone who follows me on Twitter, everyone who follows my responses to Tristan Riddell's Star Trek question of the day knows that I must be very excited about the fact that Ensign Leffler is apparently running for U.S. Senate.
You know, I saw the rundown here, Chris, and I was kind of shocked, but then it made sense to me. I think that Ashley Judd, aka Ensign Leffler, was very affected by her own laws, and I think she wants to enact some of those laws so that next year, after she's nominated, she'll be using those laws as a basis for some laws she'll want to put in action in the U.S. Senate. Not in Kentucky, but I'm sure that she's going to be trying to get nationwide recognition of these laws. So better start memorizing them now, folks, because before you know it, we're all going to be beholden to her laws.
That's right. Leffler's laws are coming to the United States. Yeah, so not to take any political stance here on the show. I just thought this was very interesting that she is going to run. Now, of course, we've seen quite a few celebrities run for office in recent years. And of course, we had Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor of California for quite a long while. But, you know, we'll see. She is, of course, she lives in Tennessee, but she went to the University of Kentucky. She still has a lot of ties to the university there, as I understand. She's a women's right activist and an environmentalist, and, you know, we'll see. I'm always in favor of new blood in the Senate either way, just because I think things get stale sometimes, no matter where you are in the world when it comes to that stuff. So hopefully Ensign Leffler will be able to lay down the law.
Well, and I mean, she'll definitely be the best-looking senator. That's for sure.
Well, I don't know. Isn't Lieberman still in there?
You know, yeah, you got a point. That's very true. Yeah, I hadn't... Man, thanks for reminding me about that, Chris. I guess I'm going to have to rethink that best-looking senator now.
You're not going to be able to sleep tonight, are you?
No, dang it.
All right, well, let's get back to some actual Star Trek stuff here. Now, someone who you would not want to be part of the Senate is Khan. And Khan is making an appearance in the latest poster from Bye Bye Robot.
This is really cool. I really like this poster. I saw this the other day, and I really enjoy poster art that kind of mimics those WPA-style posters that, of course, were made famous with all of the national parks. I actually have some on my wall in my room. And so this poster would, I think, fit perfectly. I also have the Cestus 3 poster that they did. And mm-hmm. This is just a fantastic poster. And honestly, after seeing this poster, I want to follow Khan. I don't know about you, Chris.
You want to. You want to unify humanity with Khan.
Just look at that face. I mean, it's just a gorgeous face. I would follow this man to the ends of the earth, I think.
Wow. He will offer you world order.
Well, you know, sometimes I look at our world and I think this place could use a little bit more order.
Well, that's true.
All joking aside, it's a beautiful poster.
It is. It's fantastic. It's illustrated by Steve Thomas. It's yet another great piece from Bye Bye Robot. They always produce beautiful work. 16 inches by 24 inches and $25. They have great prices on their posters. I'm still bummed that they can't ship internationally. I know it's not their fault. I know that they want to. I really wish that they would, because seriously, it's Star Trek. How far away from the basic ideals of Star Trek, CBS, can you get than to restrict the sale of Star Trek posters to a single country? Star Trek is about the world coming together and being united. I think that, you know, as a fan here in Japan, I should be able to order a Bye Bye Robot poster if I want to and have it sent to me. But hopefully all of you in the States anyway can get this fantastic poster.
It is something that I'm actually thinking about getting. I'm about to move into a larger room in the house that I live in. I have a little bit more wall space. I saw this new poster, so it's very tempting because it is a really nice looking poster.
Yeah, it's really great. Now, we're not going to talk about the movie quite yet, but I just want to bring up one point. I was talking to John Tenuto yesterday, and you know, he still firmly believes, as I kind of do now too, that Khan is in the film and Cumberbatch is either Khan or working with Khan. He pointed out to me that it's not a coincidence that there are like five different Khan collectibles being released to the spring. Do you see a connection there?
You know, that is definitely a good thought. You know, I hadn't really put that together, but that would make sense that, you know, when the movie comes out, we all see it and then we realize, okay, it was Khan. I think that this would be perfect thing to have already had out and available, so that, you know, on StarTrek.com, then as the movie's coming out, you can roll out, well, now you can get all this great Khan merchandise. And so it is funny, of course, that all of this merchandise revolves around Ricardo Montalban's Khan, obviously.
Well, of course.
And so, you know, if you're hoping to get Khan merchandise and he actually is in Star Trek Into Darkness, this Khan merchandise really won't fit so well with that film. But,
right.
You know, I think, though, this really goes more to show how much Star Trek fans respond to anything to do with The Wrath of Khan. And that it really, yeah, it is the best Star Trek movie for most people out there. And, you know, I'm drawn to it, and it's not my favorite of the films, but I still love this poster art. I would love to see them do one having something to do with Star Trek VI personally.
Well, that's your favorite film, right?
Yes, exactly. That's why I'm asking for it.
What was, John said yesterday, he tweeted this. He said, "I grow fatigued. That is why I now look like Cumberbatch." So I also found it interesting yesterday that I went to Apple.com, to trailers.apple.com, to the movie trailers, and I searched for Star Trek Into Darkness because I wanted to see if that new trailer, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, that was cut to go before Oz, was available there. It wasn't available there, but there were two Star Trek movies that had trailers available there, Star Trek Into Darkness and The Wrath of Khan.
Interesting.
Why was The Wrath of Khan trailer available in iTunes trailer suddenly? It hasn't been there recently. So, interesting. So, anyway, if you want to get this poster, we'll put a link here in the Enhanced and in the show notes, and you can hop over to Bye Bye Robot. Now, Matthew, let's take a break and tell folks a little bit about our sponsor, Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create professional websites, blogs, and portfolios. And I've been using Squarespace personally for 5 years now, maybe even going on 6. It's absolutely amazing. I couldn't do my work without it. Trek FM wouldn't exist without it, honestly, because it makes it so easy for us to build the site and bring all of this content to you so we could focus on talking about Star Trek instead of, you know, coding our website all the time. And it's just an amazing, fast and easy platform to use.
You know, Chris, one of the things that I really like about Squarespace is that it has over 300 fonts you can choose from when you're setting up your website. And for me, I don't know what it is, but I'm just really a font guy. I will spend, if I'm doing something on Photoshop or my own website I have, if I'm doing that, I will spend hours looking for the right fonts, because to me, it really sets the tone of the website. And I really appreciate that Squarespace gives you over 300 to choose from, so you can pick that perfect font to really set the tone when people see your header on your Squarespace website. It'll just fit exactly what you want. So I'm really pleased that they've done things like that to really make this as customizable as possible for you.
Yeah, it is really important to help you make a site that's uniquely your own. You know, a lot of people shy away from the idea of template-based sites. Myself as a designer, sometimes if I talk to other designers about, you know, starting off from a template, oh, a template, I can't do that. It's not custom. But actually, with Squarespace, the templates have hundreds of customization options. And like you said, 300 fonts built in, which is fantastic. And you can even go a step beyond that. If you're like me and you're a professional designer and you're tied into all the Adobe Creative Cloud tools, as I am, and you have Typekit, Squarespace also has Typekit integration. So you can enter your Typekit code into your Squarespace site, and then you can go to Typekit and you can create all of your font sets there like you normally would. And you can use those in addition to the 300 fonts that are built into Squarespace. So really, you know, if you are a typophile, if you love great typography, you will not find any platform that gives you the kind of flexibility to design and realize your vision like you'll find with Squarespace.
Well, and we definitely live in a social media world. And the other thing I think that makes Squarespace so great is that they give you the best mobile experience. You can automatically pull in from Instagram for your site, share pages on Facebook, auto-publish on Twitter, and add the social media buttons to connect with all the different services you love, whichever those are. I mean, and there's some great ones here, whether it's, you know, Dropbox, LinkedIn, Pinterest, you know, any social network that you might want to use to help promote your site, they've got it set up so that you can do that. And we know in this world, if you're trying to get out there, that's the best way to do it. And Squarespace makes it so easy.
Yeah, definitely. Going beyond social media buttons, which of course are great, and the integration is great, on the back end of Squarespace, there is a social media section where you can connect all this, and you just tie it right in, you put in your ID. Extremely simple. Another feature that's really cool is the ability to share pages on Facebook. So on your if it's a personal blog, or if it's a business, a larger website like Trek FM is, and you have a company page, either way, you can actually take pages from your Squarespace site and just share them directly on Facebook. So to give you an example with Trek FM, if you go to our Facebook page and, you know, we have all these little boxes across the bottom where, like, you can tie in your photos there, you can tie in other bits of information that you want to share beneath the timeline header. If you click on that, there's actually one that says share a Squarespace page. And you can choose a page, you can designate a page from your Squarespace site that will be shared on Facebook. And that's a kind of integration that I have not found anywhere else. And it makes self-promotion incredibly simple and effective.
Squarespace really just is, I think, Chris, the place to go. You know, like you said, whether you're a professional and trying to increase your business online through a very good-looking website. I mean, Trek FM is a great example of what Squarespace can offer. Or just looking for a personal blog, a place to share your thoughts, but you actually want it to look professional. You want it to look good. You want it to look like you spent hours doing it, but don't necessarily have hours to put into it. Squarespace is the place for you.
Definitely so. And the one other feature that they just added recently, which we should mention, is the commerce feature. Because if you're building a business website, there's a good chance that you may want to sell products on there. But even if you're an individual, you may want to sell products. You know, for example, our friend Kate, who does, you know, crochet Starfleet officers and other animals and all, she may want to sell those on her blog. And using the commerce feature, she could be up and running in just a matter of minutes because they tie together with Stripe to allow you to process orders, take credit card payments right from your website. I've set up commerce on websites before. It can be quite cumbersome and quite difficult to do. Squarespace makes it very, very simple with their new commerce feature. And it integrates right into the template. You can sell physical products. You can sell digital goods. You can offer coupon codes as well. It can handle collecting the information for the shipping. It's really a fantastic platform. And it's really inexpensive. So let's tell everyone about the pricing real quick. If you want this full-blown commerce feature, that's just $24 per month, which is already very inexpensive because you're getting hosting, the best, most stable hosting that you'll find, and you're getting the CMS. Below that, you can get the unlimited package minus the commerce features for just $16 per month, or you can get for $8 a month the regular package, which probably gives most people everything they want. So we'd like to invite you to go try it out. You can go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK3 for March. That's offer code TREK3. And you can get 10% off your lifetime purchase at Squarespace. But you don't have to pay up front. You just go sign up. You get a 14-day free trial. They don't even ask you for a credit card. You get access to all the tools in Squarespace. And you can build out your site. You can even import your site from WordPress or other blogging platforms. You'll see exactly what it looks like. And then after 14 days, if you love it, and we know you will, you just sign up. Use offer code TREK3, and you'll be supporting our sponsor and helping us bring all this programming to you at the same time.
Dark, you can't come soon enough for me. Saved from one more day of misery. Everything I love, get back for me now. Everyone I love, I need you now. Don't forget a million miles from me. Safe and another day.
So, Matthew, as we move into movie news and rumors, it looks like the way things are going, we may get this movie a lot sooner than we think. We may even just get it next Tuesday, because those release dates, they're moving on up.
Well, I think this is great, Chris. I think this is great, especially for the people around the world who are wanting to see this film, and they saw their release date when it first came out, was on Star Trek movie.com, and they're like, wait, this is, I'm gonna have to wait this long to see this movie.
That's how I felt.
Exactly. Well, and unfortunately, Japan was not one that really moved up much. In Australia, people are gonna be able to see this film on the 9th, as well as New Zealand, Austria on the 9th, Germany on the 9th, Switzerland in the German speaking areas, the United Kingdom, they'll be getting it on the 9th as well. And then you've got Ireland, that's right, and having a point. And then, of course, Mexico, May 10th.
On the 10th, yeah.
And then, unfortunately, I don't know why, but Japan, August 23rd. What's wrong with your country?
I don't know what's going on here, because, you know, we had the earliest media event for this movie, but we have the latest release date of any country in the entire world. Now, you said we didn't move up much. We actually moved up a lot. We moved up from the middle of September to August 23rd, whereas everyone else only moved up a week. However, we still have the latest release date. So, I don't know. As we say in Japan, shogunai.
You're going to have to avoid Twitter for like 2 months to have the movie spoiled for you.
The problem for me is doing this show and doing Trek FM, I'm going to find a friend who has access to a military base.
Okay, and I'll go that would be great.
On the normal release date. That's what I had to do back in 1999 with Star Wars Episode One. We went to see that on a military base.
So, oh, well, and you just walked out going, yippee!
What was pretty nice, because, you know, movie tickets in Japan typically run about $24 probably, but it was only a dollar to see Phantom Menace on the military base. That was a pretty good deal.
That is definitely a good deal.
That's pretty good. So just a note for everyone that these release dates are moving up. You can go to the official, it's the Paramount website that has this information. And we'll put a link in the enhanced podcast here. If you want to tap your screen, we'll put it in the show notes. And you'll be able to go there and find out what your local release date is. The actual domain for this list is apps.paramountpictures.com.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's also want to note for the fans out there that StarTrek.com was reporting that the IMAX 3D screenings for the 15th are selling out now. And so if you are wanting to see the film early before anybody else in the United States, make sure you get that app so you can get that screening before anybody else. And, you know, of course, be bragging on Twitter. I've already seen it. And so as well as them adding an additional showtime at 11 p.m. At select theaters. And so apparently this is really starting to take off for them.
Yeah, it seems that way. Now, a lot of people do want to see the movie in 3D. I would just like to see it a week early, personally, but that would be nice indeed.
Well, I do have my tickets as well. My sister and my brother-in-law and I are going to go see it that Wednesday. I'm really excited. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And from the newest preview I saw on Friday, I think it's just going to be a great film, and I'm really excited to see what this movie has in store.
I guess when Zoe said that this is the kind of film that was made for 3D, people really are believing her, and that's why it's selling out.
Well, it was Zoe Saldana. Why wouldn't I believe her?
Well, that's true. I'm just hoping that somewhere in the movie, there's a great 3D barrel roll.
Oh my gosh, the thought of, you know, Spock doing a barrel roll and coming right at you, and you feel like his feet are going to hit you in the face, that would be just, you know, 3D gold.
It definitely would. All right, so let's get into a little bit of what we've learned from some recent trailers and screenings. Now, this is a big spoiler warning. If you don't want to know anything about the movie, you probably want to skip to the next chapter where we're going to start our feature discussion this week of Little Green Men, because we are going to talk about quite a few spoilers right here, as well as the latest trailer that has come out. So that's your spoiler warning. Okay, now let's move on, Matthew. Now, you and I have speculated on this quite a bit on Literary Treks about the possibility of Alex Marcus appearing in the movie and the possibility of Peter Weller playing Alex Marcus, and apparently that has now been confirmed.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting. You know, we've been reading Countdown to Darkness on Literary Treks. In fact, the third issue comes out this coming week, and so that'll be very exciting. And I'm really now even more excited to see if he plays any kind of part in this comic. I mean, he was just mentioned. And so it feels like that they might actually finally introduce him to us somehow. And really goes to show that this Countdown to Darkness comic is very much setting up the stage for the film. And so I'm very excited to see that as well. Plus, you know, I just watched Batman, The Dark Knight Returns, and he actually played the voice of Batman in the film. And so it was kind of neat to get to see Peter Weller do something like that. So I think he's going to make a fantastic addition to this cast that's already stellar.
It's good that we find out that he's actually going to be in the movie playing a role in the movie, because we knew from the comic that definitely he must be the father of Carol Marcus, and they're setting that up to show why Carol Marcus might be in the movie, but we weren't sure if he would really appear in the movie. So yeah, apparently he is. So now we know who Peter Weller is playing. So no more speculation about Peter Weller being Khan, which was something we also thought could be a possibility.
It does make it interesting to wonder now if Cumberbatch will actually be playing Khan, and if they have just been pulling our leg in some ways with this John Harrison bit. And so, it can still happen. It can always happen with Star Trek that, a character can be one name but actually be called another. Chris, what do you think on that?
Well, they're definitely pulling our leg. He's not John Harrison. There was an interview with J.J. I didn't put it in the show notes for some reason, but there was an interview I read a couple of days ago with J.J., and they were asking him, it was actually J.J. and Cumberbatch, and they were asking him about the character, and he says the character that Cumberbatch is playing. He doesn't say John Harrison. We're going to find out who the character really is. Now, as we've said many times, maybe the character will call himself John Harrison as a cover in the beginning of the movie. I really, really don't think that the character's name is John Harrison. I think this is all a big ruse to keep us off track leading up to the movie. And I really am now thinking that Cumberbatch is playing Khan. Now, thank the gods that George Lucas isn't involved in this project, or we'd already know everything that's going on, right?
Well, that's true. It was hard for him to keep any kind of secret when doing episodes 1, 2, and 3. Although, of course, at that point, a lot of the things we already knew, story points, what was going to happen. Yeah. And so, but, with Star Trek, this is definitely uncharted territory, and the story is uncharted. We might be getting some characters that we kind of know, but as we know from the previous film, everything in this universe is quite different. And I guess in some ways, when I first thought about it being Khan, I was a little trepidatious about that. But I guess the more I go along, the more I'm thinking, okay, I feel like you guys can do this well.
I don't care if it's Khan in the movie. I just have always said I don't want them to just rehash the Wrath of Khan. Now, I think they're clearly not rehashing the Wrath of Khan. And so what if they're reusing characters? I mean, Carol Marcus is in the movie. That doesn't make any sense in terms of the timeline that we know in the prime timeline. She was not on the Enterprise at this point in any episode that we saw. We only learned in The Wrath of Khan that she had a relationship with Kirk in the past. So, not a big deal for me. So, for those who don't know, now that we're fully into spoilers, if you haven't read the comic yet, Alex Marcus was Robert April's first officer aboard the Enterprise, and he's now an admiral in the movie. So that is the role that he's going to be playing. And, it's a bit of a spoiler, but it doesn't tell us anything about what's going to happen in the story. So it's just, it makes you even more curious, I think.
Definitely. I love the fact that we're getting these tidbits now, because it really is just increasing my appetite for this film. And they're giving us, I think, just the right amount of information to make us speculate even more. And as y'all have talked about on the Ready Room repeatedly, everything we have got has only raised more questions. It hasn't really given us a lot of answers. And so telling us that Peter Weller is playing, this character, Alex Marcus, just blows open the amount of questions that we can have. Is Robert April himself as well going to be in the film that we don't know about? How does this all work together? Will Harrison have any connection with Robert April or Alex Marcus himself? I mean, it just really kind of starts to boggle the mind what could actually happen in this film.
Yeah. Now, the way this came out is that there were two screenings. There were extended screenings. There was one done in London where they showed the first 30 minutes of the film. And then there was one done in Sao Paulo, Brazil, where they showed 38 minutes of the film. So that's where all this information is coming from. They're actually seeing it. I mean, the media is seeing it happening on the screen, and they're just reporting about the characters and what they see going on. Here's a couple of other tidbits from the extended screening. Tell me what you think about these, Matthew. Now, I didn't get to see the IMAX preview, the 9-minute IMAX preview. that had come out, but I think you saw it, right?
I did, actually.
Okay. So we've talked about, Greg and I talked about on here before, the possibility that in the final cut, they would reorder the sequence of scenes because it felt like the opening the movie in the hospital just didn't really work as an opening. And from these extended screenings that have been done now for the media over the past week, that's what they've done. Apparently, the movie does now begin with the Nibiru volcano sequence. What do you think about
that? That's actually pretty exciting, I think. You know, you start the movie off with a bang and really just kind of open the film in a huge way, in a lot the same way that the original 2009 movie opened. You know, it was a really exciting scene. You were immediately pulled into it. I really think that this opening shot and this opening scene is really going to pull us into the film. It's also as action oriented as it is. You know, we know that it's going to be very character driven as well. The decisions that Kirk's going to be making, Spock's going to be making, all of these decisions are going to drive this entire film. I think that's a perfect way to open this film because, you know, the last film, again, it also opened on a lot of great character moments that kind of sucked you into that story immediately.
Right.
And I don't know about you, but I mean, 2009 always brings a tear to my eye. And I don't know if that'll happen here exactly, but I do think it's going to have a huge emotional payoff.
Yeah. So I'm glad to see that they've done this, even though I didn't see it myself. Just hearing about it and just thinking creatively about, well, okay, if we open the film with this slow hospital scene and then we go to the volcano, it kind of did make sense. And I suspected they would probably flip that, and it seems that they have done that. A couple of other quick things here. This one I found interesting because we talked about how Kirk became captain too quickly in the 2009 film, and then we wondered, well, what's going to happen after that? How's the crew going to come together? How far ahead are they going to jump in this next movie in terms of time frame? But basically centering on Kirk as captain. So what has been seen in these screenings is that Kirk is demoted for violating the Prime Directive. That's something I think people pretty much kind of guessed, especially if you've been following the comics, that it was leading up to that. What I did find interesting is that Pike takes command of the Enterprise again with Kirk as his first officer.
Yeah, I think that this is going to be really interesting. I think it's a great idea to show that you can't necessarily just give this young pup the flagship of the Federation early. And I think it's really going to help legitimize that film from 2009 in a lot of ways. The fact that they are showing that this is probably quite premature, even though, you know, Kirk has all of these capabilities, he just isn't, you know, been kind of honed into the man that he's going to be. Pike even says to him, look, I believe in you, in one of the trailers. And so it's not that that's not there. You know, Kirk just doesn't have any seasoning yet.
Right. Yeah. So if we're looking for character growth, we may actually be getting character growth in here. Now, let's jump to the last topic of news today. And I've watched this new trailer online, and I think you saw it in the theater. It's a new teaser trailer that was cut to run before Oz. Now, I personally hate this trailer. What did you think about this trailer?
You know, I didn't really mind the trailer. I just felt like it was just a bunch of different scenes from the movie trying to get you excited. I think the way that this trailer is cut as well is definitely meant to be more kid-friendly. For the audience of Oz, which was definitely the audience that was there when I saw the movie on Friday. And there were some fun scenes that they added, as well as giving us just a little bit more backstory to the kind of Kirk-Pike relationship, which I thought were key. The scenes where he talks about, do you know how much of a pain, and you can tell they cut out the word ass there, which I thought was very funny. And you know, Kirk's like, yes, I think I can. Yeah. And then the fact that he also says, look, I believe in you. And so the fact that this character of Kirk, I think, is really, again, going to go through the ringer. This might be his kind of Empire Strikes Back moment, you know, where Luke has to go and get trained by Yoda and he's not quite ready. I think this is really that moment for Kirk.
Except Yoda will be played by Kienzer in this movie.
Yeah, and actually, I think they actually have the same syntax when they talk. And so that should be really interesting as well.
It should be.
You said you didn't like it, though. What did you not like about it?
Well, I agree with you that the scenes with Kirk and Pike are important, you know, to kind of establishing what might be going on with Kirk's character. So I have different reactions to it. The first time I watched it, I was like, ah, gosh, really? But then I stopped because, you know, I am a marketer and that's my profession that I work in. I know when I say I'm a designer, marketer, I'm a communications, like a Marcom designer. So from that point of view, I totally get what they're doing. They cherry-picked scenes from the movie to cut a trailer that was appropriate for that audience because they're trying to get this younger, non-Trekkie audience interested in the movie. And so in that respect, I think they did a great job. I think that that trailer probably connects with the target audience, and that's fine. But what concerns me is it's available online as well. So Trekkies are going to go, everyone's going to watch this, and everyone's going to go, oh, great. He's just making an action movie. It looks like Star Wars. It's not Star Trek. I was already thinking I'm probably not going to go see this movie, and now I'm definitely not going to go see this movie. That's how I think a lot of Trekkies will react to this trailer.
You know what? What's funny is you say that, because my reaction to the trailer was, I felt so many Trekkies, you know, just kind of through the collective Federation vibe that this movie, oh no, they're so worried it's just going to be so dark and that Star Trek is going dark. But what I got from this trailer is that Star Trek is going to go Star Trek. It's going to be Star Trek. I feel like that we're going to talk about things like the Prime Directive with Kirk and Pike. We're going to talk about things like the movie's going to be funny. It's going to have those lighthearted moments that we're so used to in a good Star Trek film. But at the same time, I think it's going to have the action, the adventure, and the excitement of a film such as First Contact or, you know, The Wrath of Khan itself. I feel like that those are the films that they're really going for. And so when I see this as a Trekkie, as a huge Star Trek fan, and I really enjoyed 2009, I think for all of its faults, I think it's a great, fun movie. And I feel like that they did the best job they could of bringing Star Trek to the masses now. I think this film looks like a winner.
Okay, well, I think that shows the diversity of Trekkies. We take it in two very different ways. But I mean, I totally agree with you on the film itself. I just didn't get that from this particular trailer. But I know that I'm not the target audience that they were going for with this trailer. But, you know, I mean, if you know that they're going to talk about the Prime Directive, then you can look at those scenes with Kirk and Pike and you can take that out of it. So yeah, I could see that. I just felt, you know, there were a lot of Star Wars type things in there. The whole the Kirk and Spock flying that ship that's shaped a lot like the Millennium Falcon and flying it sideways so they can get through the hole in time. And
you're all clear, kid. Now let's blow this thing and go home.
The Scotty with the big fish. It's kind of like young Obi-Wan saying, there's always a bigger fish. And I just kind of got that vibe from it. So I was a little disappointed in this trailer, but yeah.
But I think that you're missing some great things. I mean, we see some great Admiral's uniforms. Pike is definitely making modifications to his Admiral's uniform. I'm hoping he's going to have a huge belt buckle.
He is doing the Admiral mods, that's for sure.
Yeah. Sulu actually punches it, but on the first try this time. So way to go, Sulu. He's learned. And then did I mention that there's a lot of jumping in this film? So if there's that much jumping, there has to be, and I repeat, there has to be at least one 3D barrel roll.
Come to say hi to the human race. They landed on my roof last night, so I put them in the shed to keep them out of sight. These little green men are in my garden. Whoops-a-daisy, I beg your pardon. I must get through and keep them safe, or they'll never get back to outer space.
The reported crash of a flying saucer in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947 is one of the most famous science-y, science fiction geek events in human history, I would say. And of course, Star Trek would have to tie into that, as they did in the very famous Deep Space Nine episode, Little Green Men. And as it turns out, those little men weren't quite as green as we may have thought. And today we're going to talk about that episode, and to help us do that, we have back with us, for the first time in quite a long time, friend of the show and a man who apparently gets around more than Riker, it's Fats Rikerbeard, Mr. Michael Fisher. Michael.
Just call me your gelatinous German shepherd.
I should say by that, all I mean is that Riker flies around the galaxy in a ship, and you apparently fly around the planet in an airplane as you travel to Europe and apparently sample all the different Dunkin' Donuts that the world has to offer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on a long-term study to determine exactly what differences exist between various international coffee and fast food chains, and I'm on a mission to try all the McDonald's burger variations I possibly can worldwide. Yes,
he's working on being Fats Rikerbeard all over again.
Yeah, I'm really working on the fats component.
That's fats.
A big focus of mine recently. That's fats.
So you were just in Europe for some conferences, I guess.
I was in Europe to cover the Mobile World Congress, which is a show where the hot new smartphones and tablets are unveiled. I was there in my capacity as a Pocket Now editor, and I handled a lot of new awesome gadgets, and I was on a lot of videos just handling stuff that I thought as a youth watching Star Trek I would never get to hold, let alone use in my daily life. So it's just, I love my job, and I love it, Chris, especially when you tweet at me from overseas, and in support of my quest to find the perfect gadget.
I love your Instagrams where you look completely wired, like you haven't slept several days, and it's Dunkin' Donuts coffee that's keeping you going.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'm just a feeble 21st century human, Chris. I haven't yet overcome my addiction to these substances yet.
Him and his
caffeine.
He's got his Red Bull that he's constantly chugging with his coffee at the same time. He's too jittery to actually handle the merchandise, so they won't actually let him hold it. You know, just kind of cradle it in his arms.
I can't even use my work computer anymore. I just can't even type anymore. I have to do everything through voice dictation.
All right. Well, let's talk about those early humans. Let's talk about not 21st century humans, but 20th century humans, who we encounter here as our Ferengi trio from Deep Space Nine find themselves thrown back in time to 1947. So, Matthew, why don't you kind of kick us off here with Little Green Men?
Well, one of the things that was funny, you know, just watching the episode, this is Nog. He's going to be going to the Academy. He's going to be the first Ferengi to join Starfleet in the same way that Worf was the first Klingon to join Starfleet. And Worf makes a very blatant and racist comment, I thought it was interesting, about Nog joining Starfleet and saying something that, to the effect of, I don't know if this is the best idea, you know, to have a Ferengi in Starfleet. And O'Brien has to gently remind him, well, you know, about 100 years ago, we didn't really think that about you. Or we did think that about you. And so I thought that was a great way to start out this episode, because I found throughout this, as funny as it is and kind of lighthearted as it is, they're kind of pushing us to think about some different issues. And this was one of them.
It certainly was. Yeah, it reminded me of a discussion that I've heard, you know, that has been raised in a lot of literature I've read and a lot of not, you know, I've seen in a lot of television and things of that sort, where you have this racial minority or former racial minority kind of chafing at the entrance of yet another racial minority. And thankfully, literature always provides us with a nice foil. In this case, it's Chief O'Brien to come along and say, listen, you're being a hypocrite. You know, in contemporary examples, I've seen it in the works of Nelson DeMille quite a lot, obviously, but I mean, oddly, but it was interesting to see kind of Star Trek do that. But the episode had so much more to comment on. It was interesting that this wasn't the meat of the episode. It was just kind of a throwaway observation right in the beginning.
Yeah, because I feel like normally in Deep Space Nine, I would agree that that's what they were going for. In this case, I'm not sure that they really were going for that. I think that it was just one of those little kind of cute throwaway lines related to the fact that Worf was the first Klingon. And it kind of shows that although Worf's a Klingon and he is always striving to be this great warrior and great Klingon, he actually is, I think, maybe quite human, because he's grown up on Earth. He went to Starfleet Academy. He's been around humans all the time. And so his view of the Ferengi, I think, is a bit of a human view, maybe. Because if it were purely a Klingon view, I mean, he might have caught himself and thought, you know, yeah, I was the first Klingon at Starfleet Academy. Nog's going to be the first Ferengi. Oh, we have something in common. I wonder if he'll sell me his tooth sharpener.
How much?
I do think of the fact, though, that, you know, honestly, when you look at like somebody like Martok, full Klingon, he doesn't really like Ferengis either. So I does seem like a human and even a Klingon tradition to just kind of discount Ferengis as being, you know, just kind of the court jester wherever they are, instead of very, you know, taking them seriously. In this episode, we'll see that, you know, characters you might not normally take seriously actually be technical wizards, like Rom. He just pulls it out of his hat and, you know, turns out to be the smartest guy in the room, drops enough techno babble to confuse B'Elanna Torres.
Oh my
Look,
God.
Rom ended up marrying Leeta, so he's obviously a technical wizard. He pulled that
off. That's well true. Pointed out.
And I think he probably learned that from Nog's program that he sells Janzia, who then gives it to Dr. Bashir, which I thought was hilarious, that Nog is peddling porn. Yes.
Yeah.
Nog peddles porn.
Like that. And what's funny is I only realized that initial absurdity of it was that, okay, Nog, your childish possession, here's your, you know, floppy disk full of JPEGs from, you know, from the early times. But then, Matt, it took you to point out the additional slap in the face that Jadzia buys it for Julian. Is that what happened?
Yes.
Yeah. She says, consider it a gift. And then the look that she gives him is wonderful.
Like, I mean, the woman who you've been striving to, whose heart you've been striving to capture for a long time, buys a Ferengi kid's used stimulation material and gives it to you as a gift. I mean, come on.
Well,
was the meanest thing I've ever seen.
Well, when we were talking about it on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
I just mentioned the fact that what in the world did Janzia and Bashir talk about? I mean, they must be really close, because apparently she knows his fantasies. And so when she hears Nog describe this program, she immediately snatches it up and gives it to Julian. So what in the world is he telling her? I just don't... Wow. They must be really close.
Yeah, right. I saw it like... They're like best friends and they're chatting all the time. And that's... You know, they happen to be opposite genders. But yeah, she knows what Bashir's into.
Except for the whole time, he's just thinking, I really just mean I would do this to you, Janzia.
Okay. Right, yeah. Oh, God. That also brought to mind the mention of Dax's feelings toward Julian in, I guess, is it Esri who tells him? She's like, you know, if it hadn't been for Worf, it would have been you. And I'm like, well, you just, then that just paints this picture of Jadzia as this very sadistic stringer alonger, doesn't it? Which is fascinating. It's just curious to see. I don't know.
She has 7 past lifetimes of experience stringing people along. So,
yeah. I don't know, though, if you could have said a more hurtful thing to somebody at that point. You know, Esri was definitely a horrible counselor at that point, telling Bashir that. Because can you imagine the woman that you really did love the most and then having her next host be like, oh, yeah, it was totally you, bro. But then, you know, that Worf guy came along, that Klingon with a bad attitude, and you're out of here. Sex was better with him.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's jump over to the core of this story, which is about Nog going to Starfleet Academy. And then, of course, I mean, the story's not really about that, but that's the setup. And it's been building for a long time, you know, the situation of Nog getting more involved, being around the humans and being influenced by them. And now he decides he wants to do something that's very different from a Ferengi, normal Ferengi. His father is very proud of him. I mean, actually, Rom really, really pulled this off, I think, as a proud parent about, you know, announcing that Nog was going to the academy. And then Quark is the true Ferengi over there scoffing in the corner.
Yeah, it did a nice job of setting up that, of inflating the tension between Rom and Quark, which was there in seasons one and two, because Rom was a little bit more, we didn't really know him as well, and he seemed a little bit more nefarious, and maybe he was just somebody for Quark to beat up on. But now Rom is an idiot by this point in the series. He's the lovable, like, moron.
But he's a smart idiot, I think.
Right, and he's of course he's like an undercover genius, which is amazing, which is why he can handle all that ridiculous amount of technobabble that he gets later in the show.
Yeah.
This is one of the few times where, you know, Deep Space Nine really kind of gives in to the technobabble, but I do kind of forgive it because it's a funny Ferengi story, and so kind of having this kind of ridiculous technobabble and the fact that Quark calls out the. I don't even know what you just said. Just do it. You know, like, nobody understands what you're talking about. So just do whatever it is you're talking about. So, I mean, they do in this episode even, you know, wink to the audience. Look, we know you have no idea what we're talking about. We don't have any idea what you're talking about. We just made some crap up. So I like that.
That's where Quark is the mouthpiece for the DS9 writers.
Exactly.
There, because when DS9 does give in to the ridiculous technobabble, they usually do it in order to make a jab like that, I think.
Yeah, and I think it would be so much more effective if they didn't, like, they didn't just fall, they didn't just step in the technobabble trap. Like, they stepped in it and then were up to their waist in quicksand, and then, like, an earthquake came along. Like, seriously, I mean, it was, like, stupid, ridiculous. And when Rom is babbling on for probably 50 seconds, I mean, poor Max Gradenchik just has this just endlessly Voyager-esque sentence full of technobabble. You've lost me at second 15. And when you come along in second 55 with Armin Shimerman's line about, it's like, I don't even know what you just said, but I love it. You're a genius. Fine. But don't make me sit through the crap leading up to it. That was when the episode started to lose me. And it never really recovered from there.
But it did show that stark difference between Rom and Quark, though, that here's Rom, this, like you said, like a undercover genius engineer, rambling on, very much not like a Ferengi. And then you've got Quark on the complete other side, who's just in it so he can smuggle things to Earth and make an extra quick strip of latinum.
Well, and I thought that was really interesting, you know, that as Quark is growing, you know, he's still really in that point where he's not going to do anything nice for somebody unless he's going to get something out of it, you know? And he hasn't gotten to that point we kind of will get to in the 6th or 7th season yet. He's still very much the nefarious Quark who's always looking for a way to make more latinum, even at the expense of somebody else, you know, and carrying something really dangerous doesn't really bother him as long as he's going to make a profit. He, you know, would put family in danger, which, you know, how Ferengis feel about family and profit. One is definitely better than the other. And so I thought that was really just a kind of a great character moment for the fact we're seeing Quark not really not really growing too much here. He's definitely stuck in being the selfish Ferengi.
He has not yet morphed into the Ferengi who installs soundproofing in his apartment for the benefit of Odo, just
right.
to be nice.
Exactly.
And I completely agree. Yeah, we still see like earlier iteration Quark in this one, and that's right. nice because it keeps him edgier and it keeps him kind of more interesting, and it gives us a reason for Deus Ex Machina Shapeshifter to hang around for the journey, which is something maybe we'll talk about in a second. I don't know. I have to pick and choose where I'm going to tear this episode apart.
Well, while we're talking about Quark, let's just jump ahead because we're talking about him being the same old Ferengi. And this being a time travel episode, and there's always the talk in Star Trek about the temporal prime directive and protecting the timeline. Now, Quark here is perfectly fine with changing history just to make a little extra money. Not only by giving the humans technology, but then he wants to go afterwards, take his ship back to Ferenginar and give the Ferengi Marauder from 400 years into the future to the Ferengi of the day. You know, we don't know at that point 400 years ago what kind of technology Ferengi had, because if I'm not mistaken, the Ferengi bought their warp capability from someone in the first place.
Yeah, this was definitely a completely different view of, you know, time travel. I thought this is, for me, where the episode helped itself in doing a time travel episode, because we weren't just going to do that same kind of Star Trek, oh no, you can't change the timeline. We're going to do one where somebody is actively trying to change the timeline and consequences be damned. They don't care, you know? And I thought that was fantastic to kind of give us time travel from a different race's perspective who doesn't have any kind of prime directive, temporal directive, any of those kind of things, you know? Quark and his greed is all about the latinum and all about the money and all about the power, and he thinks he can control these humans. He thinks they're gullible. He thinks they're stupid. Well, they're not as dumb and stupid as he thinks, because they're also paranoid, which makes them pretty powerful and scary, and he doesn't realize that. And so just all that together, I think, is one of the things where the writers take an episode that could be mediocre, I think, and make it better. Because if this is just some Starfleet people doing a time travel episode, I'm going to be bored.
Well, and there is a call out to a previous episode with Starfleet officers doing that time travel thing, right?
Exactly.
We have Nog, like, with the pad that Dr. Bashir gave him. You know, it's like, doesn't this Gabriel Bell look a lot like Captain Sisko? And it was great. I mean, it was perfect. It was a nice instance of DS9 calling attention to itself and saying, yeah, we did this time travel story before. Now we're going to do it different because we're going to see it from another perspective. And I agree. I think that is one of the not as low points of this episode. Yes, I completely agree with you.
Well,
he started to say strength, but no, it's one of the not as low points.
Very few strengths in this episode.
Well, and it was, you know, it's definitely great too, because it's one of those instances, again, where Deep Space Nine just gives itself continuity, and it's not afraid to do that. It just throws in, well, of course, if somebody sees history at all and is reading it, they're going to get to those Bell riots and be like, doesn't this look a lot like that captain we've got on Deep Space Nine? What the heck happened?
Sure. Yeah. I loved it. I actually didn't know that they were going to be... I didn't remember the insert shot. I didn't think that they were actually going to show the shot of Captain
Sisko
pad. And when they did, I was like, I remember that. That was great.
The future must be so interesting. They're reading through, like, why do so many of Mark Twain's later novels have androids in them?
Yeah.
was he the first one who wrote that book, Do Androids Dream?
That's right.
Right. So before we get off of continuity, because I know we're going to in a second, I need to talk about, you know, this episode did some screwed up things to DS9's continuity. I think it may be the first time we see a Ferengi actually interested in gold, because it was established pretty early on in the series that latinum was the liquid inside worthless gold. Like, gold was just used to hold it.
Right, yeah.
And so we have Quark kind of bargaining in gold, and he's like, gold is good. So, okay, we do that. And then we do this thing where Vulcans apparently don't have warp drive, but we learn later they do. And there's this kind of Star Trek screw-ups that get when you have this massive empire. But we have this awesome, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, the first time that we associate waste extraction directly with the bathroom on a spacecraft. Because we know that Rom has worked in waste extraction before, but for me, waste extraction is a nebulous enough term that I didn't think it necessarily meant that Rom was working on the station's toilet system. But, like, he has this great line in this episode where he's like, what about when you go to waste extraction? And he's very clearly talking about, like, you know, the head on this Ferengi shuttlecraft. And I'm like, I had completely forgotten about this. So it cements for me Rom's utter lack of any kind of seniority on the maintenance staff, like, later on. Did you guys know this? Like, did you just take DS9 at its word that waste extraction was sanitation? Or because I never did. It took this episode for me to firm that up.
I did. Yeah. Just one of it for me. I never really thought about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I think it's
just like taking yeah, the joke. Yeah.
I always thought it was one of those things that was the least savory job in any, yeah. you know, like, job on the Federation or any kind of starbase or something. You know, being on waste extraction is definitely the worst.
Yeah. Like, even my roommate sitting next to me was an occasional Star Trek watcher. He was like, waste extraction? What are they pull it out of you? What's going on? I don't know. I don't
they attach a little vacuum pump and
oh, God.
Yeah. flip
oh,
a switch.
It's just a transporter, maybe. You know, that would be a really awesome way to do it.
It transports it out. So future toilets are kind of like transporter. You sit down, but it actually beams. Okay.
Right.
I never thought about that, Michael. Wow.
I didn't know this was going to be the poop episode.
You're welcome.
Oh, goodness.
Never thought about that. Okay, well, okay, since we're talking about technology, why don't we talk about the other technology in here, which is the Universal Translator. And I also think it's the first time where we see the actual functioning of the Universal Translator.
I think it is, too. And I found
that, I mean, in terms of how it malfunctions and how, like, maybe different people sound to one another if it's not functioning properly.
It was so cool to see this in its initial airing, because I was so excited that Star Trek was finally... It was always kind of assumed that there was some kind of translation software. And guys, did we... On DS9, preceding this episode, was it season 2 when that species comes through the wormhole and they have that universal translator problem and they have to talk through it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking... Okay, so
I think it's the Skreeans who come in and they can't
yes.
understand mm-hmm. them yet.
So. Yeah, Promised Land or something like that, right? And so DS9 has sort of tackled this before, and but to see the Ferengi working on these implanted pieces of technology that do this job, I think allows future Star Trek to build on this, because after this episode, the writers feel free to suggest that the Universal Translator is built into the comm badges. And for me, it just enhances the fabric of the universe so much, because up until now, or up until recently in the timeline, we've kind of just had to give Star Trek the kind of, okay, do what you want. We know you got to be able to talk to the aliens. But it's a very Star Trek solution to the problem. They're like, no, we're not satisfied with that. We're going to invent some technology and put it in the Ferengi's heads. And then when it comes to Starfleet folks, we're going to say it's in the comm badges, or, you know, it's great.
But are you sure that they weren't just adjusting their babblefish?
That's what I was thinking.
Just, you know, it just wasn't because quite lodged in there, or maybe it hadn't been right. fed in a while. You know, it wasn't enough earwax or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anytime you start saying not enough earwax, I tend to think that they're doing just fine on that.
Well, yeah.
I think there's plenty of room in a Ferengi ear for a babelfish. Maybe even an extra large babelfish.
I didn't know they came in Probably. Sizes.
Yeah, just the larger ones help you understand more and more languages.
I just thought the larger ones, when they wiggled, it was like umaks.
That's why they're so popular. That's why the Ferengi don't want to have it built into any kind of comm badge or any kind of jewelry. They want it in the ear.
Right. So anytime it goes wrong, they're getting, it's like, oh, man, yeah. that thing's broken.
Well, what again. Happens is when you get the message and it vibrates.
Well, see, this is resonating with me because I'm spending my second week now with my Pebble smartwatch, which I'm wearing right now. So every time I get a message, my wrist vibrates with this very bone jarring thing. And I'm like, oh, well, what if that was not on my wrist? Awesome questions. Awesome questions on the Ready Room tonight.
Does Pebble make one of those? I didn't know that. Boy, I gotta stop getting my news purely from tech publications.
It's yeah. good idea.
I have no idea what those guys are doing over there at Pocket Now.
Those Pocket Now, don't trust them.
But it was interesting to see how it might sound to one species when this universal translator is malfunctioning.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nice little, it was cool the first moment.
Be able to hear Ferengi, yeah.
Okay, so the premise of the story, of course, is an alternate explanation for the crash in Roswell, New Mexico, which I think, you know, by this point in time today in 2013, the details have pretty much come to light and we pretty much know what was going on and what actually crashed and what the U.S. military was doing. Of course, there are going to be plenty of those people out there who think it's still all a lie and that the government's covering up. But at this point in time, when this episode was written, this was in 1995, most of this information is not really known, I think. And so there really was still this mysticism about Roswell. And I've always been very interested in the whole Roswell story as well. So what did you think about putting this Star Trek spin on it so that they can tie his, another famous event in our history that didn't involve Nazis, unlike many of the other Star Trek time travel episodes, tying it into our history with Roswell and Ferengi of all people?
So I think Matt will have the more balanced answer to your question. So I will go ahead and jump in. And first, I thought that the idea, Chris, is excellent. And I too have been, I think like most Americans, recreationally fascinated by Roswell. I watched Roswell when it was a UPN series back in the day, I think right about the time this episode was airing. And it was fascinating. And it was the 50th anniversary of Roswell, I think. It was kind of the tribute idea. So I think it was really cool for Star Trek to do a Roswell episode. And I think the concept is a good one. I think the execution fell completely flat for me. I think that if this had been a two-part episode, they would have had a lot more time to tell the story properly, because they were trying to squeeze a lot into this, and within the confines of the 45 minutes they had, I don't think they were able to do it terribly effectively. And I would have liked to have cared about Faith Garland or whatever her name was, the nurse woman, yeah. and her forward thinking professor husband, and I would have liked to hate the general a little bit more for things other than stereotypically chomping on a cigar and being a gravel-voiced dude. So I think this episode yeah. was trapped by the fact that it was confined in a single episode. It could have been a brilliant two-parter, and I think it was a rough one-parter for me.
Hmm. For me, I would say that I watched this episode again today. I haven't seen it in a little while. I just, you know, did my rewatch, but season 4 was months and months ago, and so getting to watch this episode again for me, I felt like was a treat. And mainly because I think that they didn't spend too much time on the Earthbound characters, because they're just going to give me a trope of who these people are. And I buy it because it comes from a 50s B movie. And so I automatically know what all these characters are going to do before they're on screen. And the moment they are on screen, I know who they're going to be. And to me, that's fine because I'm in that world. They've placed me in that, you know, 50s B movie, and I'm enjoying it because that's what they're going for. And I think that it's funny, and they're giving us that Star Trek spin on Roswell. And so, you know, the minute we're there, I am just enjoying the ride that they're giving me, and kind of then what they'll go on to do with, you know, comparing humans and Ferengis and where they're different, where they're similar is an interesting thing for me. And so I didn't necessarily need to know more about the 50s characters, you know, the 1947, you know, general and all those kind of things, because they've given me enough to know exactly who they are, even if I don't see it on screen, because I've seen enough of these type of films. And that's okay for me, because I feel like if I had stretched this out to two episodes, they might have been lacking material. But that, for me, that's my, my opinion.
I don't know. I think it depends on what you wanted out of this episode. So I think that Matthew's view is the more commonly held view among Star Trek fans.
And
probably closer to mine. Like, this is one of the rare cases in Deep Space Nine where I'm just enjoying kind of a humorous episode, and I'm not really looking for anything else out of it other than just to be entertained a little bit by the absurdity of Quark and Rom and Nog being taken into custody by the U.S. military and Quark trying to turn it into another business deal. But I have talked to other fans who feel the same way that you do, Michael, that the episode fails because it's too cliche and there are too many stereotypes and the military officers are just complete cardboard cutouts and archetypes of these characters. But I guess it depends on what you want from the episode. Now, if you wanted like a true Deep Space Nine type of story where they really delved into some issues, this could have been a two-parter and they could have taken a serious spin on it and they could have delved more into the whole idea of the development of atomic weapons and how humans were destroying themselves, and they could have delved into like the dangers of overdone, like of greed and capitalism a bit more. But I don't think that's what they were going for personally. Although if you read some of the background information about the episode, maybe they kind of were going that way and they didn't quite get there.
Well, that's the thing. Reading the background info is critical, because for me, I mean, if you're going to do an homage, awesome. I didn't know that that's what they were going for when I watched the episode. It took reading the background information to understand that they were they not only wanted to resurrect the memory of these 50s B movies, but they wanted to inhabit it for a second. And we know that DS9 can do this. DS9 is not an incompetent show, and they did it really well in Far Beyond the Stars, which I think is one of the best DS9 episodes that there is. So we know they're capable of doing this. I just think it failed on this one. And I think it failed in part because the show is full of what Star Trek does when Star Trek goes wrong. I want to like write a book called like When Star Trek Goes Bad, because it's like it is this. When Star Trek can do social commentary in a subtle way, it's great. But it can very rarely do social commentary in a subtle way. So even Ira Stephen Bear was complaining about how they did the cigarette smoking thing. Like that, by the fifth time, Quark was like, "Let me give you some advice. Quit smoking them cigarettes." I'm like, "Shut up! I do not need this Schoolhouse Rock treatment of tobacco smoke." And I understand that we're against nuclear fission bombs in Star Trek. I get it.
And don't forget that this was the time in the U.S. when the tobacco industry had just been slammed by the U.S. government and was being forced to pay very dearly for all the deceptions of the past. So yeah, that was very much a right out in the open jab at that point.
Right. And I think importantly, it wasn't a time when like the tobacco industry had just won a crucial victory and needed to be slapped down. Like it's like, we know. I didn't need that. There was so much in this episode I didn't need. And I think that part of this, if you like the Ferengi, if you're able to like enjoy what subtleties exist in the Ferengi, then you can really enjoy this episode. I admittedly cannot. I think the Ferengi are decidedly one note, and it's so fun to watch Armin Shimerman and Max Gridenschik particularly find the levels and find what's playable in there, because they can be so flat in the wrong hands. And I'm glad that we were treated to those actors.
What I really liked about the episode, though, was the fact that, you know, we've done past tense where they go back in time. It's really serious. They harken back to that, actually, with Sisko and the Bell Riots. You know, we're going to have Far Beyond the Stars. They're going to do some really serious episodes like this. You know, Deep Space Nine knows how to do serious. And I think the point of this is more to be like a beautiful homage to the past in the same way you do Trials and Tribulations. It's meant to be a fun, enjoyable romp, it's not meant to necessarily make you think and to give you that. It's just supposed to be fun and funny. And hey, we're also going to celebrate the enjoyment of whether or not aliens came to Earth in 1947 in Roswell. And what we're going to tell you is that it was the Ferengi, and we're going to wink at you while we do it. You know, so for me, I think that's really enjoyable because I do think the writing staff knows when to be serious on Deep Space Nine and really go for it. And I think more here, their goal is not to drive home tons of points, but to give us an enjoyable, silly episode based around the experience of, you know, 1947 Roswell.
And I think that goal is an admirable and awesome one. And I completely agree, Matt, that was the goal. I think you and I just disagree on whether the execution actually achieved it. And I don't think it did. And then you know, and this is what's the beautiful thing about it is that Star Trek actually does give us both, right? Because we can enjoy the super serious side of it, and we can enjoy the romps. I remember trying to defend Star Trek IV to a friend of mine who absolutely hated Star Trek IV, and I actually said the same thing. I was like, "No, it's a fun romp. What's the problem?" And he's like, "Oh, a romp!" And then we had this whole, you know, it was lovely. But it's so nice that Star Trek is actually large enough to accommodate such divergent viewpoints on things.
Yeah,
like
well, it depends on what you're looking for. I mean, I think this boils down to the fact that there are a lot of Star Trek fans that just simply don't like Deep Space Nine and they love Voyager. And I think it depends on what you're looking for in the story, too. Because if you just want kind of the more, not to say that Voyager never delves into issues, because it does, but it's much more the straightforward Starfleet technology, let's explore some unknown space kind of story out there in the 24th century, whereas Deep Space Nine is more about the introspective, let's explore ourselves type of story. And so this is a microcosm of that here, just in one episode, where I think we're looking maybe for different things in the story. At the time that it came on, I loved this episode just because I completely took it as a fun break from everything that was going on. And it was kind of like, oh, you know, they panned down to the calendar and it says 1947 on it. And I'm like, aha, Ferengi. That's what happened at Roswell. It was the Ferengi. I never expected that. So it was, for me, a fun moment. You talked about the Ferengi being one note. I think as a race, they are. And I think, as you were saying, Michael, that Quark and Rom are not necessarily one note characters, especially not by the end of the series. They're definitely not one note characters. And Gritinchik and Shimmerman here do find those nuances that they can play off of to make those characters a bit more interesting. And
well, I think that's one of those things, Chris, that you just hit, is that a lot of times we think of the Ferengi as one note, but then we get that this whole episode is based around the fact that Nog is going to be the first Ferengi in Starfleet, and definitely a complete deviation from where any Ferengi would want to go. I think that that's what was so interesting too for me about this episode, is that you're going to take a very minor character in Deep Space Nine and you're going to give them a whole episode of development, and you're really going to delve into who this character is and what they want to do with their life and all of those kind of things. I thought it was fascinating. In fact, you know, as we've talked about on the Orb, I think, you know, Nog really gets a better character development than Jake does in the end.
Yeah,
and it's a great character arc. And this is such a minor character. But in the end of this episode, I have more knowledge about Nog and who he is and what he wants for his life than I ever do about half the other characters in the other series of Star Trek. You know, whether it's Next Generation, Voyager. I mean, this is pretty amazing that they're going to do this kind of work with a minor character in Deep Space Nine. I really appreciate that because it makes me love when they guest star on all of these different episodes, because I'm more invested than the next time Nog comes back, the next time I see him, because he'll have been at Starfleet Academy. And I remember that, you know, I'll remember that Rom is a genius in hiding, and that Quark secretly wants to take over the universe like Pinky in the Brain. So now,
that would be a great comic series, right? A series in which Quark makes evil schemes, maybe not evil, but just schemes to take over the universe.
Can I ask a question of you guys? Do you like Nog better as his original self or as Starfleet Nog?
I'll say I like Nog in each part of his progression. I like him at the beginning that he's kind of this skeeving, conniving Ferengi who doesn't really like humans. But then I like that his friendship with, you know, Jake really kind of tempers him and makes him want more. And then I really enjoy seeing what they do with Nog and things like It's Only a Paper Moon. Into those other episodes, I think he's a fantastic character no matter where he is. But I really do enjoy seeing them take the way they did Worf with, you know, the first Klingon in Starfleet and giving us a Ferengi, the first Ferengi in Starfleet, and it being Nog. I think it really, really works for me.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm really a big fan of Nog's character in general, but what I do appreciate is pretty much what Matthew said, which is that there is a character arc there, that he becomes a very different person by the end of the series, and you see so much growth in how he sees the world and how he interacts with others, and that he has an ambition that I think we can associate with, and we can actually see in Nog, in his path from that little conniving Ferengi who's stealing things, an emissary, to the officer who by the end of the series is playing an important role aboard the Defiant and actually helping to defend the Alpha Quadrant from, you know, domination by the aptly named Dominion.
That is well put, gentlemen. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that. I needed some balance in my viewpoint of Nog, because for me, this is when this episode marks kind of the decline of Nog for me, not as a character. You know, he definitely, I agree, I love seeing an arc, but Nog, military cadet Nog, is so stiff. And I don't think it's Aaron Eisenberg's fault, and I don't think it's the writing's fault. I think the character is rightly stiff. He's a cadet, and he's overdoing it in every aspect. But being exposed to that person is very annoying. And it's like, yes, sir. Carrying around a phaser rifle and sleeping in his uniform. And I'm like, God, this is annoying. And when Jake is annoyed with him later, I don't know. I don't want to get into it. I'm just like, it's the first time I ever agreed with Jake Sisko. Yeah. I'm like, totally, man.
Well, I think you're right. I think that's one of the things that they do with Nog that really helps show those kind of the balance that he does need in his life. And that he'll get later on as he kind of grows out of that academy-ness, which he gets, you know. I mean, he's around Chief O'Brien, who's one of the most laid-back guys, and he kind of becomes, I think, a Chief O'Brien in the end, somebody who can just roll with the punches. And I think it's a really fun character arc. And yeah, does he get annoying sometimes? Damn right he does, but we all get annoying sometimes.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, I mean, you're Fats Riker beard. You're never annoying.
Well, what are you going to do? Good point.
It is interesting that starting with Jake and Nog as friends early in the series, and the fact that Jake is a main character per se and Nog is just a supporting character, that it is Nog who ends up getting all the character development, and Jake is just kind of left to hang, as it were, through most of the series. And then he gets into the final shot. But let's talk about the comparing human and Ferengi attitudes a little bit, because, you know, the core of this is when Quark realizes, at least he feels, that he can manipulate these humans, and they're kind of shocked by, well, Quark is seeing firsthand the difference between the humans that he knows and where they were 400 years earlier. So that sets up the basis for them to compare the development of the two societies.
Yeah. What is it? Quark has that great line where he's talking about, these aren't the humans we know from the station. These guys are primitive and greedy. And then Nog is the one who comes with that counterpoint, Chris, that you just mentioned, which is really great. But Uncle, and he lays out the timeline of human advancement. And he's like, they developed to their current state in half the time it took Ferengi to do so. And then they start quoting Rules of Acquisition. But that is one of the things that Star Trek does really consistently, is it's like delves into this human potential argument where it's like, Yeah, we're not perfect, but we're moving really, really quickly, and that's almost always a good thing.
Well, talk about rules of acquisition, though. After watching this, I want an audiobook, the complete unabridged Rules of Acquisition, read by Rom.
But annotated by Quark.
But Rom, he puts so much passion, you know, into the rules here. And they just sound so much more interesting when they come from Rom.
You know,
everything sounds more interesting coming from Rom. Sorry.
I thought it was really interesting the fact that, you know, the Ferengi have always been a kind of a mirror for 20th century humans and kind of our greed and our excessive uses of capitalism and how we have been willing to kind of run over anyone, you know, the kind of the Gordon Geckos of the universe. And yet I thought it was interesting the different parallels where, you know, the humans see these Ferengi and they're kind of, you know, just taken aback by them. You know, even the general is like, I don't even know if I like you. You seem like a used car salesman, like my brother-in-law, and I don't even like him. And he's not even that good at it, you know? And then at the other side, you see the kind of the savagery, or at least what humans do when they're threatened, you know, and the time period that they're in. You know, humans are very worried all over the globe about nuclear holocaust. They're very suspicious of just about anyone being a red. And these Americans are going to do what needs to be done to make sure that their country's safe. And many of the same questions that we have today about terrorists, terrorism, you know, torture, all of those things came to my mind when he's holding that scalpel at Quark's neck, you know, very Zero Dark 30. What are we going to do to get the information? And I thought that was really interesting that those same things still resonate now. And, you know, in some ways, humans have grown a lot. But as we look at, say, something like Star Trek, we can see there's a lot of places we still have yet to go, and we have a long way to go. And then I just enjoyed the fact that for this storyline, the scientists there kind of give us the picture of what will become, and at least kind of giving us some hope. Because otherwise, you know, you look at these humans and you're like, wow, it's not really much to go on here, you know? But I do think it's really interesting that in the end, Quark really underestimates humans, as he always does. And he's always at a detriment for doing so, that we always seem to surprise him.
I was starting to think about that. You make a good point, Matt. That is a prescient comment in retrospect. On my rewatch of the episode, when the scalpel-wielding interrogator is at Quark's throat, and Quark is like, don't you people have laws against this? And his response is, not when it comes to national security, which today, frankly, after a decade of being exposed to that very same line, pretty much verbatim in about every awful movie there is, and some good ones, you know, it's preachy and it's annoying. In 1995, that was less common. And I think maybe even a little insightful on the part of the writing team as to what our future might contain as far as government overreaching and things of that sort. So, yeah, I think that was maybe a nugget of initially perceived awful that turned out to be good.
Well, and I think, too, you know, I think the writers are doing a good job of looking back and seeing that would be their line. You know, that's what they would be thinking. You know, sure. They are worried sick about, you know, communism spreading all over the United States. We know from history that there really are agents everywhere in the United States at that point, and they've infiltrated the highest levels. And so what do you do and how do you protect yourself and who are you going to be because of the policies that you enact really does get played out a tiny bit in this episode. And again, it makes us think, especially in the time we are in today. And I like the fact that the show from 1995 is making me think those same things today. And even if you don't love the episode, this is one of those things where I think Deep Space Nine excels. Even at its episodes you don't necessarily like, it's going to make you think something. And this is a silly Ferengi episode. So that is a strength that you can't take away.
Yeah, just don't show this to anyone who has never watched DS9 before.
Right. Yeah, that would give them the wrong impression of DS9. That's for sure. Yeah. but it is good. I mean, showing us where we came from. And I mean, although the characters themselves may be stiff and cardboard cutouts and very cliche, the paranoia, the lack of ethics in certain situations, the greed of humanity is very real. I mean, we see that here, and that's something that has to be overcome in order to reach that Star Trek future. And so even though this is, I still think, intended, despite what the background information says about what creatively they were going for in terms of an homage to B-movies, it is ultimately, I think, intended to be one of those fun moments of Deep Space Nine. And but they can still use that to set up, and like you said, Matthew, make us think about where we were and where we have to go. So we didn't talk about Odo the dog. Now,
I love Odo so much.
Why is Odo so good at imitating a German shepherd, but he can't do a human face?
You know what's great about that effect? And yeah, that is weird that he can do a German shepherd so well and not a human. But you know, the effect was definitely not as good as what we can do today. But I still, in some of those transitions when he's changing from the dog into Odo and vice versa, you know, guys, it doesn't look bad. DS9's effects have held up well in some regards, and I think this is an example of that.
I was thinking that, too. I was thinking the whole episode. I can't wait to see this in HD. I think it's going to be fantastic. I didn't see any moments, you know, really special effects-wise or anything where we're going to think, oh, man, that's just terrible in HD. Right. And so every time I see Deep Space Nine, I cannot wait to see the kind of the richness and the deepness and the lighting and all that. In a high definition look.
Yeah.
Odo is a German shepherd. Maybe he just, you know, really enjoys the fur. Who knows?
You know what I love? It is possible. I mean, I would probably spend a lot of time as a German shepherd.
Yeah.
If I were Odo. But what's interesting to me about this, and this will be the last time I dog the episode. Ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
It's like Odo shows up, and it's like, actually, and I'd forgotten that he does show up. So it was a genuine surprise to me tonight in the rewatch. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. Odo comes along. He's like, I'm going to get you, Quark, and I've been here the whole time and blah, 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 blah. And then he totally goes away. And Odo's gone for something like 15 straight minutes of episode runtime until they're really in hardcore trouble. And then he shows back up like right at the end to be like, all right, can we go now? Like,
well, he shows up to beat everyone up, though. He's gone, like you said, for a long time until they need someone to save them. And then he appears and he starts punching everybody and he saves them. And right. And she says, who is that? And Quark says, my hero.
Yeah. It's yes. Because he was back on the shuttle and he was studying Andorian fight scene moves so that he could get it just right.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
So that when he needed was... to, like, yeah, that's why yeah. He was in super action mode. I mean, he comes out and he's just, he's perfect timing. It's like he was kung fu fighting.
It is true. My roommates commented on it. He was like, oh, you know what? It's good that both Odo and Nog have been trained in the double-fisted Kirk punch that can knock out pretty much anyone.
Yeah, there's no defense against that.
No, no, there's not. No, that's... initial impression.
This all makes so much more sense now, Matthew. I was wondering why he was so well prepared to fight them, but yes, studying the Andorian techniques.
That
was, you know, it's too bad he didn't do like blue antenna on his head or something. He's a shapeshifter. Come on, let's
well,
really,
that
really
would have been. If he had done that, I don't even know if he would have had to fight them. They would have just been so in awe of the fact that this blue antenna guy showed up too. I mean, that would have completely blown their, you know, expectations of green men.
And while they're doing this homage to the past. I mean, one of those military officers should have crawled over to the wall and reached up and hit a comm system and called in to headquarters and said,
I've been attacked by an Andorian.
That would have been great. Well, you know, it's funny. Speaking of homages, I was watching Mad Men last night. And, you know, obviously then that show, they smoke all the time. And I really appreciated that this is still a point on TV where we could have people smoking all the time because it's time period appropriate. And it not be like, well, no, we can only show them have a cigarette, but they can't take a puff. I mean, this just felt more realistic because everybody's smoking all the time, and that's just the way it was. And I thought that was funny. And, you know, Michael pointed out the fact that, you know, they're going to make a comment on that all the time. But I was just like, I'm just glad that we're at that point in 1995, but it's okay to show people smoking.
Well, yeah, I think it should be fine to show if it's a period piece. And now, I Mad Men, for me, is a little bit overboard. I know my wife and I, when we watched Mad Men, were like, could you just cut back a little bit, maybe, you know, just a tad, you know? But that's one thing I like about in Japan with cartoons is that we have the original cuts of Looney Tunes and such where, you know, if a character's smoking, he's still smoking. They just put a thing on the screen at the beginning and they say, look, to honor the creative integrity of the original, there's going to be some scenes in this cartoon. Whereas in the States, you know, these days they would go through and cut stuff out because, God forbid, you show anything that might have happened in the past that wouldn't be acceptable now. So, but yeah, I get your point here. All right. Well, we're approaching an hour of our time in Roswell, New Mexico, and I think we've hit on a lot of the key points here. Are there any final thoughts that you have about the episode, Mr. Michael Fisher?
Yeah, I would say that if you are watching this through the lens of a diehard Star Trek fan, you know, there is a lot to like within this episode, and it's certainly not one you should miss, because regardless of how many pages of things I find wrong with it, it remains one of the most significant episodes of DS9 and is consistently rated as one of the more popular ones. So clearly I'm just a negative old man. But I would say that this is not an episode that I've said it already, that I would show to somebody who is new to DS9, because whether you like it or not, I think it's pretty easy to agree that it does not reflect DS9's usual style.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't really reflect what DS9 is capable of in what I will call, rather pretentiously, meaningful storytelling. And so I think it has its place. It is not an episode I will be rushing back to go rewatch. And I only hope that one day mankind will travel to the stars and take its place in a vast alliance of planets.
A federation of planets.
Oh, yes, that's right. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You know, I did rewatch this episode today, getting ready, and I just really enjoyed just kind of the fun of it. Like I said earlier, I enjoyed all the little homages to the 50s B movie out there. The fact that they were willing to go there, at least try this. I think this is one of the things that I love about Deep Space Nine. And even, like Michael said, even if it fails a little bit, they're willing to take kind of a huge risk and really give us an opportunity to kind of celebrate in a way that I thought was a lot of fun. I think that this episode succeeds fairly well. I think that it's one of the best Ferengi episodes. You know, a lot of people out there will complain about Deep Space Nine's Ferengi episodes, but I think this one, you can pop it in and I can pop it in, and I'm never like, you know, and I love Deep Space Nine, but I'm never like, oh man, another Ferengi episode. I pop this one in and I know that I'm going to have a great time because I think it hits on all the points that I want a Ferengi episode to do. And it really does, for me, entertain me the whole way through.
So what's your rating of this episode?
You know, I'm going to give this 8 Nog porn programs.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, that's a pretty good rating. I kind of agree with both of you on this. Ultimately, for me, it's just a fun episode. I spend so much of my time examining Deep Space Nine in depth and really, really looking for the meaningful storytelling, as you said, Michael. And there are only a handful of episodes in all of Deep Space Nine that I think you can pull out and say, this is one of DS9's fun moments, because it's such a heavy series. And for me, this is one of those. And there's definitely stuff in here that you can read into and you can dig deep and look for some social commentary, you know, maybe in a way that you might not do in something like Take Me Out to the Holosuite, unless you're looking to find out just how Vulcans approach the game of baseball. But for me, this one is one of the good Ferengi stories. I like seeing the interplay between Quark and Rom and Nog. I like seeing the reactions. I just like seeing them in Roswell. So I kind of give this one a pass on its failings, which, as you point them out, I can definitely see that. But I like this one. I'm going to give it 8 morphing German shepherds. Now, Michael, we didn't get a rating from you.
That's true. I actually was going to apologize for forgetting that thing. You know, I'm away so often, Chris. I mess up protocol and, you know, I'm just always so full of Romulan ale, I forget stuff. But I'm very glad we talked about this one, guys, and I'm very glad that you helped me see the pluses in this one. But I still would only give it about 3 chewed up soggy General's cigars.
Wow. All right. Well, all right then. But yeah, it was a fun discussion, and I think also, I mean, I noticed you pointed out a lot of things that I've never really paid attention in this episode to in terms of its shortcomings as well. And now I can see where some other people I talked to recently might be coming from when they said that they kind of have a love-hate relationship with this episode. So Michael, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs.
I can be found on the internet at twitter.com. I am I'm tweeting rather frequently from my Twitter account at Captain2Phones. Captain, the number 2 phones, where I talk about mobile technology and my capacity as a Pocket Now editor. And I'm also at Fats Rikerbeard on Twitter, tweeting somewhat less frequently about everything else.
Yeah, I think Captain2Phones is the place to catch you these days.
It really is. Yeah, it is definitely the place I have gone as I've amassed a pool of friends and people I like talking technology with. And increasingly, I talk about Star Trek over there, too. So, yes, please do follow me and we will chat. And before I forget, thank you again for having me on the show, Chris. It is always lovely to be on. And Matt, I love sharing the air with you as well. Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Oh, thank you. It was great.
Always a pleasure to have you with us, Michael.
Well, Chris, that was a really fun discussion about Little Green Men. I always enjoy when Michael and I are on the show together. He's such a great guy. And, you know, even though we disagreed about the episode, I think we were able to come to, you know, a little bit of agreement about some things that we could enjoy. And really, honestly, this is one of those Deep Space Nine episodes that I think you can just pop in and enjoy without having to do a huge rewatch of the series.
Yeah, that's very true. And yeah, I love having Michael on, one of my very favorite guests on the Ready Room. And like you said, a great thing about Michael is that he always brings a very well thought out view to whatever we're discussing. So yeah, we may not always agree on everything, but you always see the reasoning behind it. And it's always a wonderful conversation.
Well, and it's great, you know, because when you have honesty of conversation, you know, not afraid to voice your opinion and also be able to think through it well and then present it well, I think you can have disagreement and it be okay. But to do it in a way that really respects the other people, I think that's one of the things that the Ready Room is all about.
Yeah, well, that's what Star Trek's all about. So let's go ahead and tell people where they can find us if they want to share their thoughts on Little Green Men or on anything we talked about during news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There is a form there, and you can choose to send to a show and send to the Ready Room. You can also find us over on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, where we're playing quite a few different games with people these days. So if you're on Facebook and you're not already following us there or liking us, as I guess the Facebook terminology would be, we'd love for you to like us. Come on, like us. We're likable. And you can play all of our games, fill in the blank in one word, rewrite the script, all kinds of stuff going on over there. You can also find us on Google Plus at hyperchannel/TrekFMGplus. And as always on Twitter under username TrekFM. And if you want a place where you can really get into some deeper discussion with us, you can go to our new forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Ready Room. There's one for Deep Space Nine. There's a dedicated section for most major topics. And we have a growing community there as well. And a lot of people are getting into deeper conversations. And that's a great opportunity when you want to talk about something that just won't quite fit into Twitter's 140 characters. Now, Matthew, what if people want to find you as well?
Well, of course, I am all over Trek FM. I am the official book reviewer for Trek FM. My book reviews can be found on the main page there, as well as in the Captain Log section. I do the shows with you as well, Chris, Literary Treks, where we talk books, comics, and the news surrounding those different things. Have a good time doing that. And of course, we're also on the Orb together every week talking Deep Space Nine, its characters, its themes, the deeper meanings behind that show, and everything surrounding Deep Space Nine. So if you did enjoy our conversation here today, I would ask you, join us there on the Orb. I think you'll really enjoy it. And then, of course, I am as well on Twitter, MattRushing02. Not getting to tweet as often as I'd like, but when I am, I'd love to have a conversation about anything with you related to Star Trek or just anything else that comes up in your mind. So give me a follow and at reply and we'll have a good chat.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, check out the Orb. We have a great time talking DS9 over there and a bit more serious than the Ready Room. But it's if you're into Deep Space Nine, I think you will definitely love that show. So check us out. If you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter under username C Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. And, you know, I'm talking about Star Trek, of course, a lot about Japan and design and this and that. I talk about a lot of stuff. We also want to encourage you to support our sponsor, Squarespace. You can go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK3 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase with Squarespace. Squarespace has everything you need to create an exceptional website or personal blog. Fantastic system. I promise you, you'll love it. Go check them out. It helps us bring this programming to you, and you'll be supporting our sponsor at the same time at squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK3. Well, Matthew, I guess that pretty much wraps up the Ready Room. But you know, after all this talking, my ear's bothering me a little bit. So I'm going to wander off and see if Nurse Garland can take a look at it.
Well, that sounds great, Chris. I do hope you find her. And it's time to stick a Ferengi tooth sharpener in it, because the Ready Room is done.